Before we begin, just let me make a special greeting to Ms. Kimberly Ross, who is the professional staff counsel for the Subcommittee on Disability Assistance and Memorial Affairs at the House Veterans Affairs Committee. And accompanying her, we have some other individuals from that staff. This is the matter of Rosenberg versus Nicholson. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would the counsel state their name for the record?
Kevin Rosenberg, appellate pro se.
Mr. Rosenberg.
Brian Tierney, appearing for the Secretary of Fire, James Nicholson.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Rosenberg, let me say at the beginning now that we have the staff members from the House Veterans Affairs Committee, but this is completely coincidental that they're not here because of your case specifically. And let me welcome you as a new attorney, as I understand, and you're representing yourself.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You will have 30 minutes to present argument. Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes.
10 minutes, all right. You may proceed.
And stated that the board lacked the authority to consider the claim of equitable estoppel. I urge this court to overturn the board's decision and to find that I am entitled to GI Bill benefits under both statutory interpretation and equitable estoppel. There are two issues in this case. First of all, did Congress intend to write a statute providing benefits for veterans for which no veteran qualifies? Secondly, once the VA determines that a veteran is eligible for benefits, can they arbitrarily reverse that decision at a later date? The facts of this case are as follows. I entered into the NRTC program at the University of Arizona in August 1992 and began receiving scholarship benefits in August 1993. During my first year of participation in the NRTC program, I did not receive any financial benefit. I was commissioned as an ensign in the United States Navy on December 18, 1996 and served until December 31, 2000. When I was honorably discharged. With war in Iraq imminent, I volunteered to return to active duty in December 2002 and was activated in February 2003. I served overseas in support of Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom and was demobilized and once again honorably discharged in May 2003. In June of 2003, I sent the necessary paperwork to the VA in order to resume my payment of my GI Bill benefits. The VA, however, treated this as a new application and applied a new interpretation of the law that was completely opposite the one used when they approved my application for benefits and awarded a certificate of eligibility in January 2002.
Now, when you received that certificate of eligibility, you had previously indicated that you knew that you were not eligible for GI Bill benefits. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. I was basically in the first, under the new law, I was pretty much in the first class people that qualified. You had to be commissioned after September 30th, 1996. I was commissioned December 18th, 1996. And since it was for ROTC, that would have been the first graduating class to qualify, the December 1996 class. The law, during my transition assistance program class, the class every service member goes through before they get out, I was informed that the law had changed. I apologize, I didn't get to your clerk early enough, but I do have a copy of their pamphlet, which I have shown to opposing counsel.
What exactly in the law had changed?
Well, before this, I think if you were commissioned after 1975 and you graduated from ROTC, you were not eligible for the GI Bill. The law changed that now they were saying if you were commissioned after September 30, 1996, and you received less than $2,000 during any one year while participating in ROTC, you were now eligible for the GI Bill. Congress intended to provide for those veterans of ROTC who did not receive a full scholarship.
Where does it say that in the statute?
The intention? Well,
where does it say what you just said, that if you participated in ROTC, you would be entitled to these benefits?
Oh, the actual section.
Why don't you take a look at 38 U.S.C. 3011?
Yes, Your Honor.
what?
A program of educational assistance under section 2107 of Title 10 is not eligible for educational assistance in the section if the individual enters on active duty.
Did you complete that program of educational assistance under 2107?
I did, in the end, complete that. I also believe that the statute was inexplicably drafted, that the minor distinction between college program midshipmen or cadets and scholarship midshipmen or cadets is unknown to most, even in the military. The fact that most people assume if you're in ROTC.
So Congress didn't know what they were doing?
I think many statutes are inexplicably drafted. I think that they did intend to...
Why don't you go on to 3B and see what it says?
It mentions the dollar amount after September 30, 1986, while participating in such program.
Which program are they referring to?
ROTC.
ROTC, not the program up above in subsection 3?
Well, I believe that that was their intent was to... there's no way...
What do you have to support their intent versus their actual written words?
Well, Your Honor, ROTC provides tuition books and fees, plus a monthly stipend.
Is a program under 2107, is there not?
Yes, there is, Your Honor.
And this specifically refers to educational assistance under section 2107 of Title 10, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it specifically refers to participating in such program, which is a subset of subsection 3, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you find that it applies to an entire, all of the ROTC programs, as opposed to just the one under section 2107?
My participation in ROTC did come under section 2107 in August 1993, once I received my three-year scholarship. Prior to that, I was still a member of ROTC.
Correct, but while you were participating in the program under section 2107 of Title 10, did you not receive more than $3,400 for each year of such participation?
That's actually, to my point, I went to a state school, and I received more than $3,400 per semester. This basically, the reading that the VA wishes to have of this statute means that no one would ever qualify for this statute. No one on ROTC scholarship is going to receive less than $3,400, or when I reply, less than $2,000 during any 1 year of participation in ROTC. It's not possible. So I think, based on that, the fact that the subsequent act that raised it from $2,000 to $3,400, it was called the Benefits Expansion Act.
What do you have to support your statement that it is not possible? There are no state schools that have funding that's less than $3,400?
Well, at the time I applied, it was less than $2,000. The rules when I applied were $2,000. And I don't find that you can go, books alone would cost $1,000.
And what do you have to support that it would be, that your total cost in every single educational institution in the United States would be more than $3,400?
Well, Your Honor, I can only assume that some of you have kids in college and know how much that's going to cost more than $2,000.
So you don't have any support?
I don't have any education data. But I do have the fact that the VA actually agreed to my interpretation. Not only in their pamphlet, which I apologize, I didn't give it to the clerk beforehand, but the other side has seen this. This is the pamphlet we received during TAP class. I can give you a copy.
TAP is what? Transition Program?
Transition Program. It's a summary. It's the VA's summary.
Well, let's move on to the fact that VA did pay you. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And they paid you for 2 years of law school?
A year and a half.
A year and a half.
Well, after active duty.
And then you left going to serve for the, in Iraq?
Not in Iraq, but for the war, yes, sir.
In the water somewhere.
Yes.
And then when you returned, you went to pursue your education further, and at that time VA said, we can no longer enroll you in the GI Bill program.
Yes, sir, and they were actually initially asking me to pay everything back.
And they waived that because they understood.
Only after media pressure.
Only after?
I had to go to the local news media and...
Well, they waived it.
Yes, sir.
And also gave you the amount for the semester just before your departure to serve in the Navy.
Yes, sir. They actually gave me one more semester. I completed 3 semesters in law school prior to returning to active duty. They waived the repayment of that, and they gave me one more semester, but they still owe 2 semesters.
And they owe it because you believe that 3011 authorizes that?
Well, under 2 theories, I believe statutory interpretation 3011 was intended to provide for those who completed ROTC without a full scholarship, but also under equitable estoppel, the fact that they paid the benefits and then sought to rescind them more than 2 years later. I mean, the VA, if I was not eligible, the VA should have known that. It was misrepresentation for them to pay benefits and give me certificate of eligibility if I damages. The issue also was decided basically in January 2002. There's actually some sort of a res judicata here. When they award the certificate of eligibility, who else other than the VA is you know, once they decide that yes, this veteran is entitled to benefits, that should be the final answer in terms of the VA's actions.
They should never be able to correct mistakes.
If they do it immediately, maybe, but I think absent fraud or misconduct on the part of the veteran, once there's a thorough review of the application, and this was the education officer for the Northeast region makes a decision. It wasn't like just an administrative person just putting a stamp on it.
What authority do you have for what appears to be a proposition that equitable estoppel is available against the government even when it is not otherwise authorized by law?
Well, in the OPM case, the Supreme Court left open whether or not the equitable estoppel could apply against the government. And in that case, they were dealing more with advice of a government official. Here, I'm dealing with an actual affirmative act. And here, the issue is not whether the court can declare me eligible for benefits if I'm not. It's whether the VA can award benefits, pay benefits, and then later change its mind.
But how can they pay you benefits if the statute doesn't allow it?
Well, I'm not asking for a monetary judgment. I'm asking to be quoted eligible for the GI Bill, and the Congress has funded the GI Bill.
How could equitable estoppel result in your being declared eligible if you are not otherwise eligible under the statute?
Well, I mean, first of all, as I said earlier, I believe I am eligible, but under equitable estoppel.
So do you agree that for equitable estoppel to apply, we have to accept your interpretation that you're otherwise eligible?
No.
All right.
No.
So what's your authority for saying to the court that you could get equitable estoppel even though you were not otherwise authorized under 3011?
Well, first of all, I think, like I said, the issue of res judicata should apply to the VA's decision. When they award a certificate of eligibility, that should be the final word. Otherwise,
what authority do you have for the proposition that VA can never correct errors?
I don't believe it was.
You're making some very broad statements. I'm just simply asking you for the authority.
Well, I mean, the issue is especially in this context, is a case of first impression. I can't cite to a case that says.
I don't think it's a case of first impression with regard to equitable estoppel. It's very clear. You have to otherwise be authorized under law.
Well,
it doesn't seem to be a case of first impression for any of your propositions, except perhaps the interpretation of 3011.
The Secretary gave you your last payment under Section 503 of Title 38. Is that correct?
Under the equitable relief, yes, Your Honor.
Have you sought equitable relief from the Secretary for the remaining year?
I did, Your Honor.
And it was denied?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Counselor, you're talking about equitable principles. Let me ask you a question. You signed in December of 1996 a form basically indicating that you understood that you were not eligible for GI benefits. Isn't that true?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I didn't see that anywhere in your brief.
Well, at the time I signed that, was not aware that the law had changed.
Okay, but why didn't you include it in your brief and advise the court that you had this waiver that you signed in 96 as an officer of this court?
Yes, sir. I know it was mentioned in the VA's brief.
Which was filed subsequent to yours.
Yes, sir.
That's a good thing they picked it up. Under your theory, sir, anyone who received a two-year ROTC scholarship would be eligible for the GI Bill. Is that an accurate statement?
As long as they meet the other date requirement, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So those who received the 4 years under your theory would not be eligible. Those who received a two-year scholarship would be.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or a three-year.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's based on what?
Well, basically, it's an equity in terms of the cost of education. You know, it's the Congress intended to provide to balance out the loss of financial support through the military program by those who don't get the full scholarship. I mean, there are some who complete ROTC without any scholarship, or maybe just even, you know, I think 2 years is the minimum. But basically, the scholarship money lost, especially if you went through a more expensive school, that 1 year or 2 years in ROTC where you're paying your own way.
But is the statute basically saying that if you receive any educational assistance to a certain extent, that affects your eligibility under the GI Bill?
It limits it to a narrower criteria, but...
And there's no gradation for 2, 3, 4 years?
Well, for 4 years, if you received... Because you would have received more than $2,000 or $3,400 if you received a four-year scholarship. You would have been above that amount, so then you would not be eligible under the current statute for the GI Bill. If you received less than that, which could be, if you go to an expensive school, that could be $30,000 or $40,000 you lost out on that 1 year. And the GI bill, at least when I was receiving it, was about $900 a month. So that would not even completely make up for the full cost you lost during that 1 year, or even more so for 2 years of not being on scholarship. And I believe that Congress intended to fill that gap by providing this.
I'd like to follow up on some queries Judge Lance brought about. On page 5 of your brief, you made an argument that specific provision of 3011C3 grants GI Bill benefits to those veterans who are commissioned after September 30th and while participating in an ROTC program. And I think we've just gone through and you've read, it says while participating in such program, referring above to the educational assistance under section 2107. In your brief, it doesn't talk about the intent of Congress and lay out the language and say that this language, the Congress just made a big mistake and their intent was opposite. And yet you're trying to argue that here.
Well, I'm trying to also point out the VA actually agreed to my interpretation in their pamphlet on page 4. They state that if you're a graduate of an ROTC program, you may still be eligible for Chapter 30 under one of the following conditions, which include if you completed ROTC without a full scholarship, or if you received a commission after September 30, 1996, you must have received less than $2,000 or less during any 1 year of your ROTC program. Furthermore, on page 31 of the record, the VA's letter asking me for more proof of no benefit during any 1 year participation in ROTC, they refer to an ROTC participation in an ROTC program. They did not refer to a scholarship program or a program of educational assistance.
Where is all that discussion in your brief is my point. Why is this being presented now? I mean, there's specific language in this statute that you don't address.
Your Honor, I mentioned in the brief that the VA's interpretation was first made that I learned at the TAP, the Transition Assistance Program class, from this pamphlet and confirmed it with the VA officer. That
so
is my brief.
Why doesn't your presentation of the argument state that Congress says this in their statute, but VA is interpreted this way? That's my question. I mean, it doesn't say that. You can go through this whole brief. It doesn't say
that. Allowing the VA to act as will ensure no veteran is safe in knowing that the benefits will be available. Are veterans going to have to stand ready to repeatedly defend their eligibility for benefits on a monthly or weekly basis? When is their finality? Finally, I'd like to move on to, as a matter of public policy, I'm effectively being penalized for volunteering to serve my country again in a time of war. If I had sat back, done nothing, and remained in law school, graduated a semester earlier, I would not be here today arguing for benefits that I was already declared eligible for. The issue would have been treated as already decided in January 2002 and not re-reviewed for no or arbitrary, reason. The fact that they notified me in the fifth semester of law school when I could not change the law schools, I think adds to the equitable stop claim that the VA must be ordered to continue paying benefits for the full 36 months of the GI Bill. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg. Mr. Tierney? Do you know why the VA gave Mr. Rosenberg GI Bill benefits?
Your Honor, I could not say why they made the erroneous decision to begin with, but the Secretary asserts that it was a clearly erroneous decision. And upon realizing that it was wrongly decided, discontinued the benefits, granted the appellant a waiver of the overpayment of benefits, and in exercise of their equitable, secretary's equitable authority, granted him another semester of eligibility.
So they determined that three semesters were unauthorized.
Correct.
And that created an overpayment.
Correct.
But then yet still paid another semester after
correct.
That.
It payments had been made and those were waived through the normal process, and then while he was in a quarter already committed legally for expenses, that's what the secretary waived. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. I think that going back to the legal analysis of the statute, the evidence clearly shows that the appellant participated in the Navy ROTC program in his first year of college. However, he did not participate in an educational assistance program as defined by 38 U.S.C. 3011 and 38 CFR 217042 until he was granted his three-year Section 2107 scholarship. And with regard to the second basis of relief requested by the appellant, to the extent that he seeks equitable relief, this court is jurisdictionally precluded.
Why do you say that? It's one thing to review the secretary's decision not to grant equitable relief, and we've said that that's not reviewable. Perhaps it might be for some constitutional problems, but otherwise not reviewable. But what authority do you have that says we can't review or consider the equitable estoppel argument? In fact, don't we have contrary authority?
I believe, Your Honor, in case of Harvey v. Brown at 6516, the court stated that equitable relief was only available under the Secretary's Section 503 authority and was not for consideration by the court.
And what's that cited again?
6416. I believe it was cited in Secretary's brief.
Well, isn't it true that in fact they actually considered whether or not equitable estoppel would be granted and found that it was not meritorious? And in Manio, 1-140, didn't we specifically say that we have jurisdiction to apply equitable defenses? Isn't there a difference between an actual award of benefits because of X and an equitable estoppel type action, as I believe the appellant was trying to suggest to this court? He'd asked us to stop you from taking away the certification.
I believe that the court has applied equitable principles for instances of a notice of appeal and that type of thing. however, with regard to the correction of administrative errors, this court's jurisdiction is defined by statute and is based on...
Well, what's our statutory authority, for example, when the secretary gets an informal claim and doesn't provide the notification to complete a formal claim? This court, I believe, is on record for saying that equitable tolling, which is no different than, in that case, equitable estoppel, will stop me from saying you can't award an earlier date for an informal claim. And this court has remand authority as appropriate, does it not?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, what the distinction there would be. To the extent that an equitable principles could be applied to provide for another effective date, I think that the case law is fairly clear that equitable estoppel will not lie to allow payment of monetary benefits that are not authorized by statute.
What about appellant's position that the Supreme Court left that open and focused more on the actual appropriation funding? In this case, his argument, as I understand it, is that the funding has been provided and he only wants the secretary to stop with regard to his certification.
I would have to disagree with his interpretation of OPM. In that case, the facts of the case are actually very similar to this case. The appellant was a federal... disabled federal worker who was receiving disability annuity. He requested information from his personnel office as to whether
mistaken, he actually granted it under his authority under B, did he not? It wasn't under A. It was because of the, as I understand it, it's because the appellant had already incurred a liability and therefore a loss, and the authority was exercised under the secretary's authority. The statute is actually skipping my mind the number, but under B, as opposed to just A.
I think you're correct.
And that the fact that he had received funds already in his hands was exercised under the waiver authority that actually could be exercised by the agency, not just the secretary.
Correct.
Counselor, as I understand Mr. Rosenberg's problem is that we have a statutory framework that appears on its face to result in the following. That a two-year scholarship recipient who received more than $3,400 a year for each of those 2 years is ineligible, accepting your argument, for the GI Bill. Is that true?
Correct.
Okay. But a four-year scholarship recipient who received $3,399 in each of the 4 years would be eligible for the GI Bill, even though the total amount of money given toward education would be far greater with the four-year recipient who would still be eligible for the GI Bill versus the two-year ROTC or three-year ROTC scholarship recipient who would not be eligible for the GI Bill. Is that a fair reading of the statutory framework that we're dealing with?
I think technically that would be the result.
Okay.
Can I add one, Judge Lance? It appears that even if in three of the 4 years he received more than $3,400, but in only one of the years received less than $3,400, he would still be eligible.
I think the way that the statute reads, that would be correct. I think, however, it's clear from the language of the statute that was the intent of Congress. The exception clearly states received more than $3,400 for each year of self-participation. I think it's clear within the confines of the statute that that refers to educational assistance under Section 2107 of Title 10, rather than a reference to Section 2101, which is the definition of definition of program that refers to the entire senior reserve officer's training corps on force. Section 2107 specifically limits itself to those members of that 2101 program that have been granted scholarship benefits and have been specially selected.
2107? The appellant seems to make the argument that he detrimentally relied on the certification by the secretary. What is the secretary's view on whether or not there was any detriment to him?
To the extent that he detrimentally relied, I believe, based upon the waiver of overpayment and the secretary's grant of equitable relief, the secretary has attempted to make him whole. I don't believe that detrimental estoppel or detrimental reliance is available at this point.
Why?
Based upon the jurisdictional limitations and also on OPM, the Richmond and that line of cases.
Was there any reliance on the appellant to continue school in January after he was notified? I think it's January 4, but
I believe by that point he had been notified that benefits were no longer available.
In the fall of 2003?
Correct. I think it was October.
October 2003.
Although there may be detrimental reliance, I think that the case law is pretty clear that no matter what the equities of the situation,
I just want to be clear on your statement. Are you saying that there is detrimental reliance, or if we were to find there's detrimental reliance, we still could not award because it's not otherwise authorized?
I think to the extent there is any detrimental reliance, it's irrelevant.
What's the secretary's view with regard to whether there is any detrimental reliance in his continued education in January of
Well, help me out. Just one. I'm just still trying to work this out in my mind now. If I have no trouble finding that if an academy graduate is certainly barred from GI Bill benefits because they have the 4 years of educational assistance.
Correct.
4 year scholarship cadet has the full 4 years of educational assistance. But if an ROTC student gets a 1 year or a 2 year scholarship, he doesn't get a 4 year scholarship, but just 2 years, he's similarly situated as those individuals who receive 4 years of educational assistance.
Correct, Your Honor. To the extent that Congress has not set up a fair system, I don't believe we have any, there's no recourse to rewrite the statute.
No, I want to make sure that is the rule, and because the actions of VA, at least in this particular case, and I don't know how many other cases maybe have occurred since 2000, or after 1996, but individuals with less than a 4 year scholarship.
Correct.
Because there were the references by the VA giving information about his participation in a non educational assisted ROTC program.
I'm not familiar with the specifics of what the pamphlet said. To the extent that it disagrees with the language of the statute would clear the control based upon erroneous information supplied by the Secretary wouldn't override when he's not authorized by Congress.
What are the procedures with regard to once someone has a certificate of eligibility and isn't in school? Appellant has suggested that if he had not served his country and then gone back, attempted to go back to school, that this would have flown through and he would have been paid. Is that correct?
I wouldn't want to conjecture what wouldn't have
happened. Are there any procedures for review on a monthly basis, or once you get the certificate, is that it?
I don't believe so. But
which don't you believe?
I don't believe that there's a mechanism for your review for basic eligibility. I know that each semester the college sends in a certificate of continuing participation.
So it was his leaving and then coming back and having to reapply that generated this?
I believe under the facts of this case it was, Your Honor.
Anything further?
Your Honor, if in summary, the provisions of 38 U.S.C. 3011C3 and 38 CFR 217042F3 are clear and unambiguous.
Okay, Mr. Rosenberg, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your
Honor. You said were you in the reserves and called up, or did you volunteer?
In December with the war coming up, I called the reserve recruiter who had been calling me since I got out of the Navy. I said, I'd like to affiliate with the unit that's going to Iraq. I then affiliated in December. We were actually activated in February of 2003. Okay. So at that point, I was called up. But my action in affiliating with reserve unit was voluntary.
You were not at that time assigned to a unit.
No, you're right. Start off by saying the clearly erroneous standard only applies to facts, as even in the Board of Veterans Appeals decision, it states that there are no facts in dispute here, and that continues, the clearly erroneous standard does not apply to this case. I just want to clarify something, Judge Kessel.
I'm not sure of your point. De novo review applies to statutory interpretation.
I'm talking, well, the clearly erroneous standard in the case of Harvey v. Brown, Hayes v. Brown only deals with facts in dispute, not matters of questions of law. As far as I think from that case, clearly erroneous standard, the case cited by the Secretary, does not apply to anything other than factual disputes. Judge Castle, I'd like to just clarify the issue with the U.S., the VA, about three semesters being paid. I just kind of missed the question. I actually had three semesters paid outright while I was a student in law school. Once I returned, they asked for that back, and then they waived the overpayment and then gave me one semester in equitable relief.
Well, for your clarification, I was simply trying to clearly understand that the process administratively, once you had the funds in your hand, is handled at below the secretary level. There's actual waiver authority before you take money back, they consider waiving it. They waived it in your case.
Yes.
process in the last court that you got had to go to the secretary because it wasn't a waiver issue. It was a, okay, you're detriment, you are committed for these funds, and at that particular time you knew. And I believe the secretary's distinction is that the follow-on quarter you knew you were not going to get funds, and yet you continued. And so that's what the secretary did not allow you to have funds, and he went under his authority, equitable authority, and the three subsets in there, and he went under the B portion.
Yes, sir. Actually, with that final point, the notification date, it was March 2003 where I got the final notification from the VA. Up to that point, we're going back and forth with letters, you know, them asking for more information. I supplied that information, and I get letters from the Navy, letters from my ROTC unit. I had been through this before in 2001, and I expected the same outcome. I expected once they got the, I figured it was a repeat of 2001, where I had to get congressional involvement, and eventually they agreed with me after almost 8 months of back and forth letters. So it wasn't until March of 04, which was because of this semester mystery in the war, was my fifth semester of law school, middle of my fifth semester of law school.
Well, you're obviously familiar with efforts that can be undertaken to get yourself some funds, and you've exercised the congressional route. You're now here in the legal route, and I'll go back to my basic questions. You're seeking equitable relief in the form of defense, equitable stop. What authority do you have that we could grant that if the statute, one, is not permitted? I know your position is it does, but if we were to find it didn't, what authority do you have that says we could grant that if the statute, if we were to find the statute is not permitted? Second, even if we did, what is the detrimental reliance? Would you not have gone to law school if you didn't have these funds?
If I didn't have the GI Bill, I would not have gone to law school in New York City. As I'm sure many of you are aware of, it's a very expensive place to live. Having $1,000 a month.
So you'd have gone somewhere else and maybe you wouldn't have spent as much money?
I definitely would not have gone to some place that's expensive in New York City. I would have chosen.
So maybe the secretary should pay you the delta between what you would have paid at school A versus school B?
I think that would come out more than the GI Bill, but...
And so you're really truly into equitable payments at that time, which are the secretary's prerogative. That's not equitable stuff.
Well, no, I'm saying that my reliance on the VA's decision was I went to a law school in New York expecting to have a GI Bill. If they had notified me during the first year of law school, I still could have changed schools, and I would have. If they said, no, you're wrong, you're not eligible, I would have gone somewhere else. The fact that they chose to notify me of a final decision in the middle of my fifth semester of law school left me no option to transfer to a different law school. With OPM, once again, the court, if I can quote, I believe it's 496 U.S. 413, says, but it remains true that we need not embrace a rule that no estoppel will lie against the government in any case. In order to decide this case, we leave for another day whether an estoppel claim could ever succeed against the government. A narrower ground decision sufficient to address the type of suit presented here. That case was not decided on equitable estoppel, it was decided on the appropriations clause. I also see a distinction between the secretary's decision to grant equitable relief versus my request to this court's to act on equitable estoppel. The VA, in re-reviewing my claim upon my return to law school, was without authority to re-examine it, and their actions were arbitrary, capricious, and an abuse of discretion. I was basically singled out for serving again, where other veterans who might be in the same exact category. And
what authority do you have for saying that the VA had no authority to review? Didn't you have to reapply?
The secretary, I didn't have to reply. I just had to send in a certification of my academic studies. That's all I had to send.
What authority do you have that says the VA couldn't review that?
The secretary had just stated there was no procedure to re-review periodically, re-review GI Bill.
So there's no practice to do it. What authority is there for your statement that they did not have authority to do that?
If there's no practice to do it, and I was singled out just for serving again in the military, I think that was abuse of discretion.
And what belief do you have that you were singled out because you served in the military as opposed to because you submitted this after a time period away? Was it your military service that caused them to take this act?
In effect, yes, Your Honor. If I had not returned to the military, I would not have missed the semester of law school.
If you had taken a leave of absence for other purposes and then wanted to go back to law school, do you think they would have acted on this differently?
I have no way of knowing that, but the fact is that I did take a leave of absence to return to active duty in the military. They took the action based on that, and as I said, there was no procedure other than me returning from the military that would have spurred this new application. application of the law and this reexamination of my case. And like I said before, the follow-on legislation that raised the limit from $2,000 to $3,400, raised the threshold limit, was even called the Benefits Expansion Act in terms of the congressional intent. I mean, just
if I understand your position, it's not the dollar amount that makes a difference. It's that Congress didn't know what they were doing, and when they wrote this provision, because it excludes everybody who's in a program, it's arbitrary and capricious.
Well, what I'm saying is that the raising the dollar amount does not necessarily change the statute, but it evidences congressional intent to benefit more veterans, not less. By naming the act the Veterans Expansion Act, it shows that they wanted to include more veterans.
Well, presumably, if 3,400 excludes everybody, which was your statement unsupported to the court, 2,000 would have excluded everybody. So the dollar amount doesn't have anything to do with your argument. It's that this Congress didn't know what they were doing. They were arbitrary and capricious when they wrote this.
Well, I think it was more due to I'm not saying they were arbitrary and capricious, I'm saying it was more due to a lack of understanding of the intricacies of the ROTC program, and that the name of the follow-on act.
Do you have any legislative history to support your position?
I do not, Your Honor. I'd just like to end by saying that, once again, I'm basically being penalized for serving my country again in time of war. This would not have occurred if I had remained in law school, and I ask the court to reverse the Board of Veterans Appeals decision. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted. We will greet the counsel, and the court will adjourn.
This honorable court is adjourned to further order.